This is Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hi, I'm Steve Chiatakis. Here in a little Tokyo rec center, white walls flank us. Feels a little officey, but hold on. Keep walking with me. A little farther down, a security guard asks for $5.
All right, so is either PayPal, Venmo, Cash App, or $5 cash?
Cool. You cough it up, hang a right, and then... Ping pong, more specifically, Little Tokyo table tennis. Relax, every Tuesday, including tonight, it's an easy place where anyone can come, hang out, and hit a little white ball really hard with a paddle.
I'll just play table tennis in New York.
No one's going to be weird. No one's going to be a dick here. Like, it's crazy. It's like this weird, like, you get like, there's like this like spell, you know, like you walk in and you're just like chill, which is like the goal.
That's Jiro Maestu, who started up this club in 2021. In fact, they're celebrating that first birthday milestone tonight. Over the past year, ping pong has showed its hipper side here in Little Tokyo and drawn together an unlikely bunch of people. Reporter Angel Carreras dropped by to get the spin on how this community came to be.
On Tuesdays from 6 to 9 o'clock, in overstimulation of the senses, what with the hypnotic back and forth of the fuck. Fuck. This is the best ping pong onomatopoeia you're going to get. Of the balls bouncing on 9 separate tables, the vibrating thump, thump, thump of the music, and then the crowd. An unexpected community of fashionistas, students, the elderly, the face tattooed, and more. I mean, you've got the beginners and transplants like Gia Bolivier.
I just moved to LA and I don't really have a community yet. Everybody, they seemed really good at ping pong, and I was like, there's no way I can do this.
There's the really good players, pros and near pros, like Ryan D, a veteran.
Most people don't even play good. They don't even know probably what they're doing, you know, for all they care, they're playing chess, but they're having fun.
D points out that there are other spots to play in town, by the way, but...
If you go to most table tennis clubs, it's more serious, it's more training, you know, I don't like that shit.
Plus the older crowd shows up here, young at heart though, no doubt. Like 64-year-old Nicole Kim. She got invited by another Little Tokyo table tennis goer.
They're young. Oh. I'm the oldest one in that group.
How old are your friends?
I don't know exactly, but they're around 20, 30,
oh,
somewhere.
Wow.
Yeah.
Visually, it's a funhouse fashion show. There's the Gen Z kids with nose piercings and really big pants, the socks and Birkenstocks clad stoner, a nurse in scrubs. There's a guy with a kilt, mesh tank top, and a blazer over it, and he looks hot in these things? A lot of people come here from the fashion world dripped out, at least their first time. Like a guy I couldn't help but notice playing table tennis in a Gucci sweater.
I saw you in the Gucci sweater playing.
Yes.
So I had to ask, like, what
yeah,
you
yeah,
did.
So it's bootleg Gucci.
It still looks great, though.
Yeah, no, that's better. It's better than the real thing.
But it's like
most people are appropriately in gym shorts on their second visit. But these people of the fashion variety, they're drawn here moths to the flame because of the founder, Jiro Maestu. Jiro rocks a dyed mullet, track pants, a torn shirt, and he still looks better than you or me in a suit. Big surprise, he's a designer by day.
The design sensibility, like the logos, the graph, like the Japanese like graphic design that goes behind, like the whatever it's like the table tennis.
You see, about 6 years back, before the table tennis obsession, Jiro went to school in Paris for pattern making and draping. He started a clothing brand named Poche. Billie Eilish has been photographed in one of their hats. Hand sews every bit of clothing he makes. So he and his friends got really into the aesthetic of table tennis. And soon, I guess, kind of into the sport. I'll let Jiro tell you about that.
My friends and I kind of started playing table tennis, like, really recreationally, kind of just the way you, like, go and do any activity, like bowling or, like, anything like that. One day we were like, let's go play ping pong. I think all of us, it was maybe, like, 10 of us, we were probably all drunk. Like, the first, like, 5 times we went to, like, a club in, like, on Olympic in Fairfax, like, in a Jewish center.
This was pre-pandemic, by the way, about 2018. Go ahead, continue, Jiro, with the story.
I think it was just, like, being, like, kind of just, like, ridiculous. So we were probably, like, super annoying at the time, like, to the people who were running the clubs. We would come in with, like, you know, like, soda cups with, like, just, like, Jack in it or something. And just, like, we would just be, like, playing and, like, messing around. It wasn't like bowling. Like I said, it was like bowling, like an activity that you go and do. But it was just kind of like we were in this room. We just had these little balls that can fly like so crazy. And it's just like this action of like whacking it and jumping around. It's kind of just like really liberating. Yeah, and it just kind of like got a few of us hooked at least, you know.
So, you know, all the funds, laughs, and fucks. Till?
Then pandemic hit.
But?
My mom had a ping pong table in her backyard, so me and, like, three friends would just play for, like, 12 hours a day for, like, a year straight. This is, like, full lockdown. Like, we told no one we were meeting up, you know, we were just like, I'll meet at 8 a.m., like, at my mom's house, and, like, we're playing in the backyard. We would play, like, all day, all night, like, not all night, but all day long, you know. It was, like, an obsessive time, which was really cool, because you can never really afford to, like, dive so deep into anything. Ever, because it's kind of like it was the end of the world, so we were like, let's just do this, you know.
You see, Jiro's workspace is just down the street from the Terasaki Budokan. That's the Little Tokyo Rec Center. So he
just kind of walked in one day and asked for the director and asked them if they were going to do a table tennis program or have a club or anything, and they kind of looked at me and said, like, you know, like, who the f- plays ping pong, you know? And I was like, I don't know. Like, I think, like, a few of us do. Like, it could probably be a cool, like, fun thing, you know? Like, everybody kind of knows how to play. And they're like, listen, like, sounds great. Like, if you want to do it, like, we have the space. They kind of just, like, gave me the freedom to do it and put it together and raise the money to buy the equipment and donate it to the Budokan. And it kind of just, like, organically took off from there.
And took off it has. Little Tokyo Table Tennis has always had a healthy amount of people since its inception. But every week now, you're going to find bleachers full of 50 or so people and sign-up sheets scribbled up with names to the margins. Back of the tables, the people that remain are smashing, driving, stroking. Table tennis terminology here, folks. 9 o'clock hits. And this little jamboree sails into the sunset. Just for a week. But what's past that week? What is the future of Little Tokyo Table Tennis? Jiro says he's been approached by brands and stores seeking to turn this into more than an enthusiast or a community kind of thing. Think intense cash tournaments and big name brands, branded events and collaboration thing. But Jiro says, worry not. He aims to keep Little Tokyo Table Tennis as it's been. Fun, fashionable, inviting, connecting for Little Tokyo.
And they show out like every week and all these connections that have been made. And something that I think is like really cool is that like I could disappear and this will still keep going at this point, you know.
Little Tokyo Table Tennis's 1 year anniversary is tonight. Happy birthday. Special time at 5 p.m. in the Terasaki Budokan. Be ready to sign up, meet a few friends, and try to dress appropriately. Gym shorts, not Gucci. For KCRW, I'm Angel Katadas.
All right, we're going to bounce for a second to coming up. The unhoused people who got pushed out of Lancaster and into the desert, how they survive with little water and shade, imagine, and what they hope for the future. The forecast for...
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause. And rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Lancaster tomorrow is sunny and 102 degrees. Same for Thursday and Friday as well. Imagine then not having shelter or access to water and being pushed into the even hotter regions of the Mojave Desert. Folks there in tents, homemade structures, and RVs, braving the extreme elements, and they're miles from help. Many say they had to move out of town by the constant harassment of local L.A. County Sheriff's deputies. Sam Levin has reported on the situation for The Guardian. He joins us now to talk about it. Hey, Sam.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Describe the scene out there in the desert north of Lancaster. I mean, what do these shelters in the Mojave look like?
Yeah, so it's just a couple miles north of city limits, and it's very desolate. You know, there's kind of sand in every direction, and you just have tents and RVs and these sort of makeshift structures that are kind of scattered in different parts of the desert there. It's very desolate. People are in very, very difficult situations, and it's extremely sort of windy and dusty out there, as you can imagine, like any sort of desert environment is. And so it's just sort of hard to get the most basic necessities, including shade and water.
Why did these folks have to leave Lancaster in the first place?
So a lot of these folks have different stories about how they ended up unhoused, but what's common for many of them is that they were previously camping on the streets of the city of Lancaster, whether in tents or sort of off old train tracks in different parts of the city. And many of them have dealt with sort of harassment and tickets from the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department, which is the police agency that provides services for Lancaster. And so a lot of them have dealt with this sort of police crackdown, which involves folks getting tickets for a wide range of things related to the fact that they are unhoused. And those tickets can come with, you know, notices to appear in court, which can then turn into warrants if people don't appear.
Lancaster's mayor, a guy named R. Rex Paris, seems to support this law enforcement crackdown, actually called many of the homeless people there thugs and criminals. Is that right?
Yeah, so he's had some pretty anti-homeless rhetoric throughout the last couple of years, and at one point had made a comment suggesting that, you know, people should arm themselves, you know, in the face of dangers posed by unhoused people, despite there not being a lot of evidence, you know, in general of unhoused people, you know, causing crime or violence. He has said in a statement to me, you know, asking about the situation that, you know, people should be held responsible for violating the law and for misdemeanors. He's also said that, you know, they try to make an effort to divert people, you know, out of the jail system, and has recognized that it's bad when people cycle in and out of jail. But at the same time, people continue to get these tickets and are not getting any offers of help or services or housing, you know, when they are facing police interactions, but rather are just being pushed out further to the margins.
You reached out to LA County Supervisor Catherine Barger, who represents Lancaster. Her office then passed you on to another agency, who then passed you on to another agency, and then on and on. So what, number one, what's the takeaway from that? And I mean, you're a reporter with lots of resources. You can't seem to get an answer from anyone about what's going on.
Yeah, it was a very frustrating, though typical, process of trying to get basic answers or even just sort of a statement about the folks who are living in these horrible conditions in the desert, and, you know, really got very little info and any sort of even acknowledgement of people living out in the desert, which shows that, you know, there's not a lot of people willing to sort of take responsibility for this. And because the folks in the desert are in this sort of no man's land, they're in unincorporated LA County land on the very edge of, you know, the northern edge of the county, you just have a lot of people sort of not taking responsibility for it. And, you know, the supervisor's office has gone out with the ACLU. The ACLU, who's been active in this, you know, have shown them around and have had them meet people. So they're very aware of the situation there and the crisis there. But they're not willing to really comment on it. And it's not clear if there's any sort of dedicated resources that are going to help these folks. Certainly the people I interviewed and talked to said, you know, that they're not really getting any help or offers of housing and services while living out in the desert. And even beyond that, you know, they're also not getting sort of basic aid, you know, like water and other sort of services that people living in that climate desperately need to survive every day.
One of the most striking pieces of information that you give is the number of unhoused people who are actually dying in the desert. In fact, a number of the people you talked to for the story recounted like near-death experiences, right? Because of lack of water, for one thing. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that.
Sure. The coroner's office of LA County provided me with data of deaths of unhoused people in Lancaster and the surrounding zip codes. And so they have logged 246 deaths of unhoused people since 2015. And that includes 17 deaths that were classified as happening in the desert. And there's already been 29 fatalities so far this year across the region. And so, you know, these are very serious numbers. This is an absolute disaster and a humanitarian crisis. And it seems that the problem is getting worse. You know, there are a lot of different causes of death, whether heat stroke, hypothermia in the winter. Some folks have been killed. There's people dying of heart disease, and there's people dying of overdose. And it's also worth noting that these numbers are considered a significant undercount. You know, the coroner's office doesn't track all deaths. And so, you know, there's likely many more unhoused people who are dying in the region. And so there's lots of individual stories I've heard. You know, I interviewed one woman named Candace who just talked about one time when she just ran out of water and no one was around. And she had, I think, like a gallon left. And she was talking about how it was so hot outside that the water had essentially overheated and it just felt too hot to even drink the remaining water she had, which she was trying to ration. And so she eventually kind of fainted and just sort of drifted off and, you know, woke up hours later when someone came with colder water and essentially helped her, you know, nurse her back to life. And she said something like, you know, I was seeing the light, or, you know, she really felt like that could have been the end. And so I think that's not an uncommon experience. I mean, folks out there do help each other, and there is communities that form, and obviously people rely on each other for supplies and, you know, just sort of sharing resources and getting rides into town and things like that. But, you know, all it takes is one really brutal day and lack of water to put you in a situation that could potentially be fatal.
What do the folks whom you talk to, Sam, want to happen? What is the ideal solution? What do they want to happen?
Yeah, most folks I talk to want housing, which may seem obvious, but I think people want permanent, stable housing. You know, I think a lot of them have been through the process of trying to get shelters or trying to get some of these other temporary programs, but those programs either didn't work for them or were temporary and ran out. And so people get stuck in this sort of cycle. And because there aren't actually, you know, just available, affordable, permanent housing for them, this is really their only option. And so people need just the basics of a roof over their head and, you know, a stable place to live. And that's really hard to get in LA County right now. I mean, the people I talk to don't want to be living out there. I think that in some ways it's preferable to the city in the sense that they deal with police harassment less, you know, they're bothered less by law enforcement. However, the conditions are so brutal that it's not desirable for any of them to be living out there.
Sam Levin, reporter for The Guardian, who did the story. Sam, thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
It's Greater LA from KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. For the long incarcerated in California, getting out of prison is deeply disorienting because of all of the variables, where to live, where and how to get a job, who to count on. Not to mention just an incredible change in the world between going in and coming out. That is the reality for a lot of folks released on parole after being sentenced to life in prison, so-called lifers. But a nun from L.A. launched a program that aims to help.
You know, my mother used to say, always look for the helpers. Anybody who is coming into a place where there's a tragedy. Oh, baby, because if you look for the helpers, you'll know that there's hope.
Sister Mary Shawn Hodges launched the Partnership for Reentry Program, or PREP, in 2002. More than 10,000 parolees have completed the coursework, and together, they have a less than 1% recidivism rate. Next month, PREP celebrates 20 years, and at the same time, will honor the sister in one big ceremony. Sister Mary Shawn is with us right now. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you. Thank you.
In so much of the material that I see concerning the organization, I read the term over and over again, restorative justice. What does that mean? And how do you apply that to someone who has, for all intents and purposes, has been forgotten in the criminal justice system and beyond?
Restorative justice is built on the concept of heal the offender and restore the relationship of the offender to the victim and the offender to the community. And gradually, only in the 2000s, the 2010s, has that term, restorative justice, caught on into the prison system. And it is gradually showing that anyone who goes to prison can be restored and all can be transformed into a new way of living.
Many, many of the folks you work with have been incarcerated for 30 years or longer. What made you want to work or feel like you needed to work with lifers, as I mentioned. You know, these are folks who have been incarcerated for such a long time.
Lifers are such a beautiful, beautiful group of people. Leaders come from the lifer population, and every one of us need to belong. And so if I don't have that belonging as a child, I'm probably going to go into drugs. I'm probably going to go into gang life. When I go to prison, I'm pretty angry about going into prison and to have a long term. And it's going to take me a while to change my way of living from a way of crime into even desiring to change my life, because I go in angry. Angry's been a mode of life for me for a long time.
I know you have a curriculum that aims to help parolees reintegrate back into the community. What are some of the steps that the students, these are students, right, of PrEP, both internally and externally, what steps do they take to get them ready to reenter society?
Very often a very first course is anger management. And the realization that many of my decisions are based on anger, and I need to look at my anger and see what's causing me anger, where did it come from, what are my triggers, and how can I live out of a healing life rather than an angry life. Another course is victim's awareness, that I have been a victim when I was a child, and that I have, because of that woundedness in me, I have victimized others. And so when I come to realize my own victimization, then I can see what I've done to another, and I begin to heal through various programs that are offered in the prisons and from many of the programs that PrEP has written.
We're living in a time when the level of justice, just justice being demonstrated in the justice system, is being questioned by a lot of folks. And, you know, after years of working in the American carceral system, are there changes that you would like to see made to help in a situation like this?
So many of the laws that have been made in the incarceration prison system have been for punishment. The three strikes law, you know, based on small, small offenses. And yet if I stole a loaf of bread for my third offense, I go in for 20 years. So there is so much legislation now that is changing all those unjust laws and is enabling a person to say, yes, I can get out, if I will follow through on my part.
Thank you so much, Sister Mary Shawn Hodges, founder of the Partnership for Reentry Program, PrEP as it's known. Sister, congratulations to you on 20 years, and may you continue for many, many more.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
That's going to do it for us today. Tomorrow, to NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory we go, where space is the place, with the folks who have eyes on the universe and beyond. Meet JPL's new director, the first woman ever in that role. That's tomorrow on GLA. Always online, by the way, at kcrw.com/GLA. What's on your mind? What story would you like to hear? You can sign up for the podcast, too, kcrw.com/GLA. Juliana Mayo, Zoe Matthews, Sonia Geis, Phil Richards, PJ Shahama, Jay Siebold, Ray Guarna, Amy Ta, Holly Adams, and Christian Bordahl. All made this evening's episode possible. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for the ear and your time tonight. Have a great evening.